Monster Man, Special Episode, Monstrous Landscapes, possibly Part 2. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, by Patreon backer Seb. If you'd like to be like Seb and get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for all other levels, including monthly bonus episodes at the $1 level, and all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, at the $2 level. So Seb, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy today's episode. Now, Seb has asked me to talk about times where the monster is the environment. The monster is the landscape. And I think, I keep thinking that I've done this already, but I think that what I have actually done is monsters that are dungeons. This is one of the problems with having, as of the day before I recorded this, I've been doing Monster Man for 6 years, and I have done over 700 episodes in the main Monster Man feed, not including bonus episodes and patron deities. So sometimes I lose track. But whether we've done this topic before, I don't think we've done the things I'm going to talk about in this episode. So the idea of a landscape monster is pretty common in fantastic literature, and often specifically takes the form of being swallowed by a whale or by some kind of sea monster. People will quibble about the idea of calling this a whale, like Jonah and the whale, arguing that it is in fact Jonah and the big fish, but like, biblical taxonomy maps to modern taxonomy in no way. You just forget about it, right? The idea that whales aren't fish is a relatively new one in many cultures. Essentially, the word fish got redefined. These things happen. Anyway, there are two pretty common forms of this motif. In the first one, we have a group of travelers who pull up next to an island and get off their boat to gather food, stretch their legs, etc., only to discover when they kindle a campfire that it is not an island at all, but a giant creature who, irritated by their fire, wakes up and they all have to run away. We've seen this type of creature in regular episodes of Monster Man. So in Season 5, the Monstrous Manual season, we saw the Saratan, which with that name is probably best known from the writings of Zakaria al-Qazwini, but that's not even the earliest Arabic source. It's also found in many other texts. It definitely predates al-Qazwini. I think the earliest known version is from the 2nd century AD, and that uses the monster's Greek name, the Aspidochiloni. But probably the most famous Western version of it is Jasconius the Whale in The Voyage of St. Brendan. This is one of those stock fantasy things that like turns up in film, but it doesn't turn up in games very much, and I think it actually suits a certain type of fantasy game very well. One where either the overall tone is sort of fairy tale-y, or one where the players have a sort of social contract not to cast too critical an eye on the logic of the setting. So not the kind of game where there would be a lot of like, wait a minute, why didn't we see that the water around the island was blah, 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 or like, well, islands aren't that small, so, or thinking about like the geography of it all, the, you know, the formation of the island, you know, none of that stuff. It would work well in, for instance, a Star Wars game. So Star Wars has a kind of social contract that the precise details of an individual scene are meant to be important, and often like have quite strict rules, but then everything around that is a bit hand wavy. So you're meant to incorporate, to pick an example from a Star Wars film that everyone cites as being like, oh, you know, it's realistic and it's more grounded and adult, Rogue One. You have to do all that stupid rigmarole with the boxes and the arms in the end when they're halfway up the tower, and you're not supposed to think about how on earth such a silly system could ever have come into being. Things matter as they are framed into the scene, and that's okay. Like, it sounds like I'm criticizing it, but I'm not. So a creature like this could absolutely exist in a Star Wars game, and I actually think that players would generally like this. My players certainly would. It's a classic. I think if you have a classic, but it's not overused, players enjoy, I mean, they enjoy the thing in itself and for itself, but then I do think they also often enjoy the sensation of participating in a classic. But I also think that you don't have to like absolutely not think about the implications of this one. It is one of those cases where you can actually include clues about the monster's behavior and habitat without necessarily falling into the trap of so-called realism. So for instance, if the creature dives so deep that when it comes up, it has kind of like deep sea stuff on its back, so the players land and they're wondering why this island has so much seaweed, or maybe like a bunch of sea life that's caught up with it when it rises to the surface, so there's all kinds of like strange fish that only live in the depths of the sea. But then also all of that sea life that's sort of, you know, died on the thing's back when it rose up into the air might attract dangerous predators that they would have to deal with. So you want to land on this island, but there's all of these, you know, pterodactyls or whatever that you have to cope with. Or like, speaking of St. Brendan, I mean, not that St. Brendan is particularly a hermit, but like, speaking of like voyaging Irish monks, maybe some hermit went and, you know, made a little hut on the back of this creature as it slept. And because hermits are really in tune with nature, for whatever reason, she didn't wake it up. Maybe she only drank rainwater and didn't kindle a fire, or maybe she's just so like harmonious with the universe that it soothed the creature even though she made a fire. So her little hut on there partly survives even though it's centuries old, and maybe, just maybe, her part of the ancient prophecy or the blue jewel is still somewhere in the ruins there. I think that could be fun too, because you could actually have the location of the hermitage be on a map, but when they go to talk to the wise wizards who own the map, the wise wizards say, obviously this is a legend because the hermit went and lived on this island, but we know that there's no island there. But then when you go there, lo and behold, there's an island. That could be fun. You could do something similar with this on land. Mountain ranges in Glorantha, at least some of them, are said to be the bodies of dragons. I believe they're dead dragons, but maybe they're not. You know, they can be awakened, I'm pretty sure, or have been awakened in the past. But I think it would actually be more fun in a wetland environment. So I live in Cambridge, which is in the east of England, and very close to the Fenland region. Now, the Fenland region is actually not really that fenny anymore. It was drained in order to make it more viable for agriculture. But in the Middle Ages, the Fenland area consisted of areas that were like wetland and water meadow, or even like open bodies of water, meres, you know, and then the pathways in and between these things might change. It was quite difficult to navigate on land, except on certain, you know, constructed causeways, except for in these islands. There were areas of high ground that essentially functioned as islands in this watery landscape. And the biggest, or at least the best known, was the Isle of Ely, which is where the cathedral was. I mean, is. And, you know, today it's not an island at all. It's just a little bit higher than the surrounding countryside. But, you know, maybe you have a situation like that medieval Isle of Ely, where there are islands of dry ground in an area that's otherwise kind of unpredictable wetland. Now, Ely means eel island. And eels were hugely important to the economy of this landscape. And I just like the idea that maybe, you know, everyone thinks it's called Eel Island because, like, that's where the good eels come from. But maybe they call it Eel Island because it is actually the back of a sleeping giant eel. Now, I know that eels are, like, the most cliche OSR monster. Every OSR thing for a long time had eels in it. I don't know. I think there's something like that. I like the idea that if it wakes, it's not even that it'll go mad or go on a rampage. It'll just swim away. I think there's some fun to have there. I like the idea. You know, one of the things that's fun about Jasconius the whale is that it represents a devil or the deep blue sea type of situation, because it's not that you have to run off of the back of the creature as it sinks to get to a safe place. You have to run to get to the ocean, which, of course, may not be that safe of a place. And so I think it works very well in any environment where both environments require effort to survive in. So that, you know, you can't just, like, run off of the back of the eel and get to dry land and say, base, you actually still have problems. The other classic monstrous landscape is the one where the landscape is inside the monster, and the monster is large enough that there's some kind of society going on in there. I think that for most people, the archetypal vision of this story is Pinocchio, although there are others, and let's be honest with ourselves, for most people it's the Disney Pinocchio. In gaming terms, probably the main example of this is Genial Jack, which you can get in two zines from Lost Pages. I've talked about it in the past. I assume there'll be more Genial Jack at some point. I have enjoyed it so far. It is a setting that is based on and in an absolutely colossal whale. It describes him as a whale god, which I think, you know, is a way to explain why Genie L. Jack is so colossal. Like, I don't think otherwise Jack does anything too divine. So this ties into a concept that we've discussed in the past, the idea of the monster being the dungeon itself. I think we talked about it in terms of an animated dungeon, like in The Eyes of the Stone Thief, but there are other possible interpretations of this concept. And I think that there are two main ways of approaching this. The first is the Genie L. Jack thing. So Genie L. Jack is just a very large mobile ecosystem. People can live on his back, in his cavernous mouth, or even in his gut, because he's absolutely colossal and he swallows all kinds of things. But it's not like he goes around looking for people to eat, and he doesn't particularly do anything to get rid of the people who are living there. He's huge and powerful, and he's just sort of unconcerned with all of this stuff going on inside him. I think there's also, I don't know anything about whale intestines, so I don't know if whale intestines are huge like that, you know what I mean? Like if you took a whale's intestines and my intestines, would the whale have a bigger circumference to their intestines, or would they just have more intestines? I don't know. But Genie L. Jack is, no one has sat down and thought, like, what is the biology of a creature this size? He's a fantastical beast, a god. He's an ordinary sized whale blown up to colossal size. And so the monster environment there is a way to have all this kinds of strange and gross stuff happening in the landscape. Like, you could have this town that's built out of the wood of all the wrecked ships that Genie L. Jack has swallowed over the centuries. And there's one that's about the gut, and there's some, you know, there's some gross stuff happening in there. But part of it is just the normal digestive processes of Genie L. Jack, and part of it is stuff that he's swallowed, and it's kind of got lodged down in there. Another version of this would be something like Fantastic Voyage, where it's not that the monster is blown up, but that the characters are shrunk down. Obviously, Fantastic Voyage, the purpose is to kind of like teach you about the functions of the different parts of the anatomy. So it's not that the white blood cells hate you, it's just that this landscape is full of dangers. If you were very small, these are the things you would have to contend with, sort of. Alternatively, you could have a monstrous landscape that was a little more actively hostile. One common way of understanding this relationship is casting it as the relationship between an immune system and some kind of pathogen entering it. A little bit like Fantastic Voyage, or like the old TSR game Snit's Revenge, designed and I think illustrated by Tom Wham. I had actually totally forgotten about this game until I saw someone doing a huge version of it at Salute this year, with like the little cartoony germs and whatever. It is a lighthearted game about being microbes in the body of a much larger being. It's got sort of cartoony art, and you play in a board that's like a diagram of a big nose. So monsters in this context that you as player characters might encounter, the obvious way to think about them is as parasites. So if you think about a human being, we have a lot of other organisms that live in or on us, and we don't even really take notice of them because they're literally too small for us to see. Different bacteria, and those bacteria aren't necessarily harmful to us. There are bacteria that cause disease, obviously, but there are also lots of bacteria that live in our bodies and, you know, help us live healthy lives, or at least don't make much difference to us. But then, of course, we're also vulnerable to other more harmful microorganisms or parasites. So anything from head lice to bacterial infections, to like fungal infections, to tapeworms. But although these things are gross, in most cases, they aren't necessarily going to put us in danger. Obviously, they're bacterial infections that can be very bad for you. But for the most part, all of these creatures can live in a larger creature, and the larger creature will continue to survive. But we could even go a step further and make these creatures not be parasitic. Let's say we have something like the Tyranids in Warhammer 40,000, right? Most science fiction games from a certain period have some monster like this, right? The Tyranids, or the Zerg, or the Cryomech, or whatever, right? Like an H.R. Giger inspired, is it Giger or Giger? An alien inspired biomechanical swarm, right? Your basic alien bug swarm, and all of their technology is biological. Remember when that was a wild and new idea? And that includes their spaceships, right? The spaceships are basically big animals. And because the Tyranids are all basically one giant organism, one hive mind, they're willing to sacrifice individual creatures for the good of the swarm. They never flee, they never betray one another. But this only works because the big creatures that connect the little ones to the hive mind are there keeping the mental connection going. And if those ones are killed, then the little ones get confused and they don't necessarily keep track of the mission very well. They often kind of go berserk and just start attacking things, but they're not out there trying to carry out the strategic objective of the swarm. So imagine that you had to infiltrate a Tyranid spaceship with the goal of killing the big monster that's doing the thinking for the whole swarm. What would be a huge place? This is, in fact, the premise. of the games, Tyranid Attack and Advanced Space Crusade, I believe. Anyway, it would be a huge place. It'd be possible for there to be like little pockets of other things, right? So survivors of orc ships that had crashed onto the surface, or creatures from some planet that the Tyranids had taken over that were waiting to be turned into biomass for the swarm, or maybe like things that the Tyranids would find indigestible, like robots or other mechanical things that their bio-assimilating strategy wouldn't be able to deal with. And the ship would also have some kind of active self-defense. So this would be a way to deal with traps. We treat traps as essentially the immune system of the creature, whether that's spitting acid, trapping you in a cyst, spawning creatures to maul you, shutting its sphincters to prevent you from getting into a different chamber. You know, there's a lot you could do with this kind of bioship, and that could be a fun dungeon. Now, this doesn't have to be in some kind of science fictional setting, although I do think that all of this biological stuff kind of fits science fiction gaming pretty well. The giant monstrosity that barfs out other monstrosities could be just like flying around like a big dragon or floating in the sea. It wouldn't have to be in space. You just need a way to get the PCs into it, like finding something that mimics the pheromones the creatures emit so that they can get past the outside defenses as long as the monsters don't get a clear look at them. And that could be a little separate mission to begin with, right? So first you have to capture one of the monsters so that the scientist, you know, the wise wizard, can extract the pheromone, and then you go into the dungeon. You could even scale this up from a dungeon, right? You could do a kind of biological planet and do a hex crawl on a world so infiltrated by the hive that all of its structures and things are essentially biological. In fact, you could do this as a three-parter. So your world is being invaded by, you know, off-brand Tyranids. First, you track down the monster that you can extract the pheromone from. You extract the pheromone. You use that to get inside the ship. You use the ship to go back to the homeworld, and there you, and it would kind of stink if you had to like blow the whole thing up, right? You'd have to do something that would like influence the evolution of these creatures so that they became less hostile or something like that. Or alternatively, you could do it alien style where you're trying to blow these creatures up, but there's some representative from the crown is there and they want to figure out how to turn them into a weapon. Either way, I think it works. So I guess we can see that there are a number of different possible themes present in the idea of the monster's landscape. So one way to do it is like the idea that I've just mentioned, emphasize the biological ickiness. You also get that in the gut sections of Genial Jack. Another way to do it would be to emphasize the mobility. So again, that's kind of like what the whale is about. The whale swallows up Jonah and then takes him to somewhere he doesn't want to be, but where the Lord wants him to be. You could also emphasize the personality of the landscape. Now, that feels more like a Jack Kirby Kill 6 Billion Demons kind of concept, where the area you're exploring is like, I don't know, the body of a god floating in the void between universes. And the personality of the deity is still reflected in what's inside of it, since gods are made of meaning. So it's not like you can necessarily communicate with this thing because it's dead, but maybe in fact you land your spelljammer ship on it and then you discover, like, well, it's not dead, it's just kind of inert. And meanwhile, some bad guys, some space pirates hired by an evil wizard are tunneling into the seemingly petrified body of this god, and they're trying to get at, you know, its heart, because if they have the heart of a god, then they can do powerful magic, yada, yada, yada. So I think there's also something in there. Now I want to write an adventure on the body of a Kirby-ish titan floating in between worlds. It's maybe a job for someone who's better at art, because it would live or die on the map, right? That's an adventure that would be all about how good the map would be. And of course, I have actually published a scenario in which the, well, dungeon in this case is the body of a monster. I'm not super proud of it. There were a lot of compromises in its creation that made it be not what I wanted it to be. But the concept I think is fun, which is that it is a fortress construct, right? So it's a mobile fortress. And it was inspired, again, not the way it came out, but the idea that I had was inspired by the graphic novel, The Moving Fortress. I forget who it's written by, but it's illustrated by Enrique Alcatena. I don't know if it's, you know, available or anything, but it's if you ever run across a copy in a secondhand bookshop, definitely check it out. I only remember the vivid impressions the art made on me when I was younger. Like, I don't remember what it's about or anything. So, well, other than that there's this fortress, right, and it's moving. So if it turns out to be like super racist or whatever, I just don't remember that from when I was a kid, and I apologize. But the art looks really good. That's the point I'm making. I think the key here would be that the meaning of the god had to be to some degree comprehensible. So we're talking Kirby god, not Cthulhu god. Kirby gods are, they're not like beyond human comprehension. They're just really extreme. They often represent ideas taken to extremes that a rational person wouldn't take them. So I think if you can do that, you'd need some way to access different aspects of the god's personality. The place would have to be living somehow, maybe even inhabited by like the angels of a dead god, but they're angels of a dead god. Sounds like a very Kirby-ish phrase, but he'd have a different name for them. They're just kind of routinely carrying out their jobs, even though there's no point to it anymore because, unlike humans, they don't truly have free will. Okay. I think these are all sound points, and that's a couple of different approaches to monsters being the landscape, and I think they all have something to recommend them. So Seb, thank you very much for your support once again, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, remember that if you'd like to be like Seb and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we will be returning to the Arabian Nights-inspired fantasy world of Al-Kadim. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.